Shalom Aleichem, everyone. Hi, it's Binyamin Hammer at National Council in Israel, and we are honored to have with us Rebbe on the line, and we are about to begin conference call number 19. Thank you, Rebbe.
Question number one, what guidance regarding how to advise singles in searching for a spouse? The first line is an hour shir. We just read the Parshas Chayesara not that long ago. In Parshas Chayesara, we read that Eliezer was told to go far away. The Ran explains in the Drasha that although they may have been over there of Avodah Zarah, even far away, but their midos were better. It's very difficult to teach midos. So therefore, he felt that go for the balas midas, and as far as the religious doctrine is concerned, it'll be much more easy to teach later on. Same thing is true to this day. What should you look for in searching for a spouse? Midas tovos. Which midas tovos? So the specific midah that is most pronounced in Parshas Chayesara is the midah of chesed, and there's an accompanying midah, which is explained by the Kliyok at great length in Parshas Chayesara, which is the midah of Tznius. He explains on the Pasuk of Hakrei No Lefonai Hayom that Eliezer was looking for a young lady that came out only B'mikra, that no one knew who she was. B'sula V'ish Lo Yida'ah. She came out only that one particular time, because those who are out in the street all the time, even if they do chesed, not necessarily a proper choice. Called Kavud Bas Melech Penima, and therefore these two midas were chosen by Eliezer to look for when he was looking for a spouse, and it's true to this day. I believe it's true in both directions. A spouse who's a man looking for a kala and a girl looking for a chosen, the same two midas, the midah of chesed and the midah of tznius. Tznius is not merely a matter of how you dress, although that's certainly included, but it's also a matter of demeanor, a matter of someone who promotes or flaunts him or herself versus someone who's more behalten, more modest, more private. These are hard meters to find nowadays, but that's what is in fact required. Okay, the second line, how should singles event be organized successfully in the spirit of Torah? Now, the phrase singles event is a fairly new phrase. In the old days, and I guess I'm going to call the more Haredi circles even today, everything was taken care of by the parents. The parents took care of the financial arrangements, and they just chose who the marriage partner should be. And all the boy and girl had to do was go out. I mean, they had veto power, obviously, but they would go out with the girls or the boys that the parents had chosen based on their best intentions to help out their children. The previous few generations there in America, it wasn't that way. People would just meet each other kacha, whether it be in a shul, whether it be in a summer camp or a similar setting. And that's how things were for quite a few years here in this country. But recently, there's a problem with sort of neither here nor there in certain circles. There are those who will not go anymore to co-ed summer camps, and there are those who are not going to go anymore to shul activities, social events, which have boys and girls together. It's not firm enough. But on the other hand, their parents aren't working full-time to try to find shidduchim for them. So they're left neither here nor there. It's a very bad situation. They enter singles events. Singles events are opportunities to meet. Of course, they have to be done in a proper way. Number one, there should be a fairly even amount of boys and girls, not always so easy to find. Ruach HaTorah, the spirit of Torah, should certainly pervade the activity. Sometimes a shir, sometimes some chesed project, something constructing, something positive. Same time, that's the asei tov. There's also a sur merah. Ruach HaTorah, spirit of Torah, does not allow for any alcoholic beverages, which is always a problem, and how much more so at a singles event. And the dress should be a proper and appropriate. Nonetheless, as important as the singles events are, and they are, and I certainly recommend them, we have in our own yeshiva something called YU Connects. They run singles events unbeknownst to the larger world, the Aguda, without publicity, is running singles events. They may start a little bit older in age, but they're doing it. They're doing it well, and there are groups in Muncie and Lakewood. They're, you know, under the table, there are many singles events. Nonetheless, an ideal way, the fact that a boy meets a girl one-on-one, what they call today a shidduch date, whether it's arranged by a professional shatrin, or a member of the family, or another just a do-gooder who knows a boy and a girl and tries to do the best for them, it's better. Now, it's obviously better if the person who's the so-called shatrin knows the parties. Well, there's been plenty of cases where a shatrin knows neither party and it works anyway. That's true. But if you're following statistics, the law of averages, you're much better off if the shatrin, in fact, does know both parties personally. These days, it's a new world called resumes. Who ever heard of resumes for shidduchim in the old years? It's resumes for a job. But you know, now that's what happens. Especially if you're a girl, it's harder for girls. You have to have a resume out there. Believe it or not, these resumes are often very helpful in ascertaining whether a particular couple should go out or not. And although they certainly don't tell everything, but they are of great assistance. And these days, as I say, there's a quote-unquote shidduch crisis. We have to try everything. Try a shatchan from the family, someone who's a friend, a professional shatchan, a singles event, a resume, whatever. Everything has to be tried in order to facilitate shidduchim as best as possible. The second paragraph of this question tells you about shidduch forms, shatchan interviews, you have a label, yeshivish, modern orthodox, machmir, modern orthodox, liberal, chassidish. What about these labels? The women are going to wear pants to cover her hair or not? Are these invasive questions about tznius appropriate and relevant halachically and hashkafically in regard to shidduchim? The answer is absolutely yes. Of course it's relevant. I believe these questions, you know, we don't like to ask them directly. In the olden days, you'd sort of find out from a third party which way the wind was blowing in these matters. But these days, they save time, and they'll put it down on a resume question. I think if they're appropriate questions, as invasive as the questioner properly refers, first of them, is invasive. They are invasive, but, you know, it could save time. If for example, the woman doesn't want to cover her hair, and it's a deal-breaker, so why should the couple go out? You may change her mind. That's not so common, and vice versa. So therefore, it seems that these are not a bad idea. Of course, the terms themselves are quite subjective. I'm not discussing the pants and the hair. Those are facts. These singles events should have people who are more or less on the same page. But the other official labels, they are a little bit problematic, frankly. A person can be yeshivish because he wears a black hat and a white shirt, but it's not Tocho Kibaro. It's not really someone who is inside is the same as his outside. And then, of course, modern Orthodox Machmir, whatever that means. Machmir means he's more Machmir than other modern Orthodox Machmirs, who are called liberals. The whole term modern is not a term I like to use. But, you know, people are, whether you like it or not, they're throwing out these labels simply in order to help facilitate shidduchim. I guess we have to accept them and try to live with them. Question number two. A Kohen married a Balas Tshuva. They now have, Baruch Hashem, have from children, some in Kolu. What did the Rav do about the Easter of Zona / Chalol? The issue, of course, is that if a woman lives with a non-Jewish man, she's not permitted to marry a Kohen subsequently. And if she does, the children are compromised. We don't know what happened in this case. The word balas tshuva is a very, very, very wide-ranging term. Doesn't tell us at what age she became a balas tshuva. Doesn't say where she was before she became a balas tshuva. Doesn't describe her personality. Even though, unfortunately, on university campuses, many, 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 most, probably a significant majority of the women are not besulos. They have boyfriends and often multiple over 4 years, and someone who's completely not from will likely not discriminate between a Jewish and a non-Jewish boyfriend. So there's a serious chance. Rav Yosha was quoted as saying that a Kohen should not marry a Balas Tshuva, presumably meant this kind of situation. But I can't generalize. You don't know for sure. Maybe this woman was an Isha Tzedekis even before she was a Balas Tshuva. She just did the right thing and stayed away from certain activities with her male friends, assuming she had some. So you don't know. If I was the new Rav coming in, I would say nothing and do nothing. Down the road, there may be a question when it comes to a wedding or something like that. So you'll figure out then what to do. Right now, there's very little to do. So to start breaking up marriages based on something which you don't know, I think this is not appropriate. If a child is asked, you have to go find out the answer to the question. It's difficult. But for the moment, since somebody was on the scene before, as the questioner mentions, didn't say anything, you're the new rub on the spot, I wouldn't start making waves concerning this particular situation. Okay. Recently converted ger v'giyores harasa shalo b'kdusha ledasa b'kdusha. What that means is that the mother converted while she was pregnant. How do you call this man up to the Torah? Mishaberech tzuba. The brief answer is that this young man has no halachically Jewish father. He has a biological father who is, I'm assuming, Jewish. The question doesn't spell it out, but that's my assumption. Unfortunately, the halacha does not recognize his fatherhood because at the time that he fathered this child, the woman was a not-Jewish woman. And there's no connection halachically between the father and the son. And therefore, it's not appropriate to call him up by that person's name, even though he's his biological father. And even though the mother converted and presumably married this man, who was spending his whole life as his father, but from a strict halakha perspective, it's not his father. So, the way he should be called towards the strict halakha is by his mother's name. Mar speaks about Mori Baruchel. That's what should be written in the Ksuba. I remember I had a case in Moscow. It's a long time ago, more than 25 years ago. I was privileged to be in Moscow. And there was a wedding. And the man who got married, they called him up to the Torah, Ben Yosef. So I was doing the Ksuba. He said, no, don't write Ben Yosef. Please write Ben Rochel. Which meant that his father was not Jewish. His grandfather, his mother's father, was Yosef. So to save embarrassment, when it came to kind of calling for an aliyah, they called him Ben Yosef. But when it came to a ksuba, which is strictly speaking has to be done, he told me I have to write down Ben Rochel, which is correct. That's what we wrote down, Ben Rochel, in that case. For an aliyah and a mishaberach, they, as we mentioned, the minhag is to use the mother's father's name, not to embarrass the fellow. If, however, the biological father is in the same place and he's known that way in the community and people don't necessarily know the whole history, there is room to be lenient and call him out by the father's name, no less than the case of adoption with a zero connection. And there still is a minigun in many places to call him up by the father's name, the adoptive father's name. Kavachom here, where there is in fact the biological father, even though from halakha perspective he's not the father. And some even write that in the ksuba, they add the word hamagadlo. There are leniencies in these areas, but every case is different, should be judged on its own merits. Okay. Number four. A congregant was expecting Bishar Tov. Her parents are divorced for many years. They have both been remarried for many years. Her father passed away this year, and her mother has told her that it would give her great grief if there would be a boy to name it after her ex-husband. The daughter is distraught. Her siblings and her stepfather are staying out of it. Her husband would like to name the baby boy after his father-in-law. Does she have to listen to her mother? This is a very, very complicated question. If a person's parents divorced, they both have it's both equal, and you can choose, Pashup Shai, you can choose to whom you wish to obey. And it's assumed that naming after a father is a form of kibud av. It's not completely clear that this is really true. The Gemara has a Masechta Kiddushin, Mechab Delacham Oso. So Pashtus, it should be true, but for those who claim that Mechab Delacham Oso is only saying the three words in the Gemara, Hareini Kaparas Mishkovo, or the equivalent today, which is Kaddish Yosom, because there, as Rashi explains, that any onesh the person has in Olam HaBo, you want to take upon yourself, and there's a Zohar about Kaddish to relieve some of the, forgive the expression, the heat in the upper world. So that's included, like you're providing services for your father, the same as you would have to turn down the heat if it was too hot in the room in this world. You have to turn down the heat, if you can, in the next world. But anything else, the Gemara on Kiddushin Lamed Aleph and Beis talks about going to a funeral, even that, or to accompany the Aron, even that, according to these poskim, the Marsha and the Tosfos Rid, are not included in Kibud Av V'Em, so presumably naming a baby wouldn't be either. Most poskim, I think, disagree and say that all other manifestations that were also considered to be Kibud, even the Acham Oso, and then she now has a quandary. Her father's covered demands that she named the baby after him, and the mother's covered by her demand is that she should not name the baby after him. Well, Pashtas, she can pick her choice, Niskarsha Shneim Shovim. Not so simple, however, because Shneim Shovim, in the case of the Gemara, they're both alive. Here in this case, they're not both alive. The mother is alive, and the father is no longer alive. And there are those who say that the difference between alive and not alive, we're not going into all the details, has to do with the Gemara Masechta the Kiddushin, that same daf, Lamed Aleph Amud Beis, where the Gemara says that Rav Asi said if he knew his mother would have died, he would not have left Eretz Yisrael to greet the Aron, and the Marshon and the Rid say because it's not considered to be Kibud Av or Aim if the parent had passed away. That's not included in Mechavta B'Moso, and others disagree, as you mentioned. There they also say that after the person passes away, there's no longer a chiyuv of Kibud Av V'Eim from the perspective of Bein Odom LaChaveiro, because these chiyuvim don't exist after death. Bein Odom LaMokum would exist. And therefore, if that's the case, that explains the Rambam's opinion that the Rosha is a chiyuv Kibud Av V'Eim. The Gemara says there isn't. So the answer is the Gemara is referring to a case where the father had passed away, and the Rambam is referring to a case where the father was alive. So presumably, it's a Bein Odom LaChaveiro, Piron Chov, he brought you into this world no matter what, if it's Russia or no Russia, but after he dies, it's no longer a Bein Odom LaChaveiro because of his passing. It's not a social contract. In any event, that being the case, it's not Shneim Shalom anymore, because your mother, there's a Chiv, a double Chiv, Bein Odom LaMalchum, Bein Odom LaChaveiro. The father, there's only a single Chiv, the Bein Odom LaMokom. So it's not so simple. However, I think that the real answer over here is the Chazanish. Chazanish says in Yerodeya, Simen Kuf Mem Tes, Sivkot Nches, in discussing the famous Tshuva of the Maharik. The Maharik says that if a person wants to marry a girl and the girl is appropriate and the father says no, you do not have to listen to the father. Why not? Some say because there's no obligation to obey a father, ever. Only have to give him food and drink, and not contradict him. Others say, no, you have to obey, because if you don't obey, you're contradicting him. The Chazanish says that's true. But he says, there's an obligation upon a parent, quote, Levatel Ritzonim Epnei Ritzon B'no Abita. It's an obligation on a parent to forget about what you want, and rather be concerned with what your child wants. The way I interpret this is that if you don't do that, your request is unreasonable. As the Chazon Ish says, if someone says to a child, give me all your money, even if you pass the Michel Ben, it's absurd. Or I give the example, the father says to the child, just run around the block all day, it's absurd. It's an unreasonable request and need not be honored. Of course, the question in our situation is it reasonable or is it not reasonable? Not knowing any of the facts, I would say the default position is that the mother is not being reasonable. Just because you were divorced from this man many, many years ago, you already remarried many, many years, as was he. But bygones be bygones. This is, after all, the mother of your daughter. Let your daughter do what she wants. I should say that, in general, parents should not mix into their children's choice of names for their own children. You had your chance with your children, I give them their chance with their children. And it's a very sore point in general when grandparents mix in and tell the child, name after this one, or in our case, don't name after this one. Let the children make their own choices. They had the baby, let them choose. It's a very, could cause a lot of stress. Shalom bayis stress and machloikis is a terrible thing. The general rule is let them do what they want. In any event, back to our case, there could, though, maybe this could be certain circumstances. We can argue that the grandmother's request might be reasonable. Perhaps her husband or ex-husband beat her, or who knows what, some extreme case where it would bring back these terrible memories whenever she would refer to the grandson who has the same name as her ex. But those are very, very rare cases, and you have to consult the Rav. This daughter should consult her Rav, like any other situation of a Shaila, explain all the facts to the Rav, and if the Rav determines that the mother's request is unreasonable, and she's chayevas levatel ritzona, mitznei ritzon bita, quote of Nach Hazanish, then I believe she can name the baby after her father, and if the mother will be disappointed, it's just too bad. You have to do what the halacha says, to disregard an unreasonable request, especially when on the other side, you have the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av. So that's why I think it's that would be the psak as a general rule, although every case, as we said, might be different. Question number 5. A non-observant Jewish colleague recommended me to her friend who was seeking a rabbi for a baby naming. They have no rabbi, no shul, no affiliation. They don't want to come to shul in their home with a few relatives present. So the rabbi agreed, only kosher food, which they were not planning on doing. So that's great. You already saved many people from eating treif. It's beautiful. Problem is, maybe the mother's not halachically Jewish. The naming is not an iser. The dangerous impression that, in fact, she is Jewish. Can you give them a Hebrew-English baby naming document, right, in Hebrew, that you do not verify her status? You see my bris and my amal. The answer is yes. That's what you should do. You should go in there and give them a document and write in Hebrew that you cannot attest to the mother's Jewishness. You never know. Maybe it's going to be a Kira project. You never know. If you come to this event and they'll see an Orthodox rabbi and he's respectful and he is pleasant and he smiles, they'll say, hey, not so bad. Maybe we'll want to go to an Orthodox shul one day. Question number 6. The non-Jewish babysitter informed the parents that she would be observing the festival of Diwali. Lunch is provided for her daily, but she said that on the appointed day, she will only be eating food that is sweet. Diwali is associated with Hindu deities, and the babysitter, upon questioning, says that she herself considers the holiday to be religious, involving prayer and fasting. But the parents allowed to supply her with these specified foods that she's not allowed to bring in any of her own food into the home. I imagine there's plenty of sweet food in the house. Whether there is a prohibition over here may in fact depend on whether eating the sweet foods on that day is an act of avodah zarah proper or not. This, of course, requires very careful examination by experts in this particular religion to tell you what the nature of eating sweet foods is on this particular day for the Diwalis, after the festival of Diwali for this Hindu religion. It's very complicated. And you can either eat, before you get to the halachic issues, it could be a dispute within the factual issues. I remember when Rav Yashiv Zatzal reverses Pesach on the Indian hair for the Shetel. So he wrote first a tshuva that it's permissible. He wrote a tshuva that it's prohibited. So one of the distinguished rabbis said to me, I don't know, I think he got it right the first time, that the facts were more in line with the first tshuva as opposed to the second tshuva. That was also related to Indian religions, and obviously it's difficult to ascertain specifics of these religions. But there was a question of whether the hair is an actual avodah zara or it's just a matter of self-sacrifice, and the details are not so critical right now, although the issue still exists. We haven't heard about it in quite a few years. I think there's a room to be makel. But here, again, it's in theory, it could be nisa d'oraisa if you're facilitating avodah zara. On the other hand, if it's not a real avodah zara, a ma'aseh avodah zara, when you eat the sweets on this Diwali holiday, then it would presumably be permissible. Question number 7. A potential new family to my shul has shared with me that their 7-year-old daughter is seriously allergic to nuts. Can the shul make an accommodation to become by being nut-free? Certainly would add to the shul morale that a new family moved in. Does the shul have an achrayus to become a nut-free environment, kiddush, offerings, etc., both inside the basic nesses and in the kiddush room? Well, in the shul, there should be no food at all. So it should certainly be nut-free. Once in a while, kids, I guess, bring in candies, and some candies have nuts. That's an easy request. No food in shul. If children bring it in, please no nuts. That's easy. We don't want to disenfranchise anybody from coming to shul proper. As far as the kiddush room is concerned, it's a little bit more sensitive. People like what they like. And I guess maybe they like nut cake or what other various delicacies. Kugels have nuts in them. I don't think it's an achrayus to make the kiddush room nut-free, but I think as a matter of chesed, it should be done. People can survive the kiddush without their favorite dish that contains nuts. They'll do very well with the other delicious Jewish foods that have no nuts in them. And I would recommend it. It's not an achrayus. I recommend it. You know, these days there are schools and summer camps where there are big signs, we're a nut-free environment. And the truth is that there are individuals who are allergic to these nuts, and they could really be dangerous to them. So as a matter of chesed, I think that someone should adopt this policy, if asked to do so, to enable a more inclusion by those who are or have children who are very allergic to nuts. Last question is question number 8. Is relative is in North Miami Beach, now carries on Shabbos some cash. If Chas V'Shalom, a similar incident happens like it did this past summer, we have what to give a mugger and hopefully not be harmed. Is this mutter? I believe Rabbi Rachman passed this way many, many years ago in Manhattan when there was a rash of muggings. And the Rabbanim did not approve of this psak. They felt that it was going a little bit too far. And that although there are muggings once in a long while, the fact that a person has a dollar to give to the mugger is not necessarily going to protect him. And it's, we call in our language, a lo shchichi azeka, not a common phenomenon. And therefore, we can perhaps suggest that shluchim mitzvah and izokin, even though you know, last week in Eretz Yisrael, we had the ultimate event. Someone, not just shluchim mitzvah, the middle of davening, as we know, there were nizokins. But that, as tragic as it is, that's in Eretz Yisrael. Talking about a milchama, there's a milchama there. Anything I say here is only for America. I'm not going to paskin for Eretz Yisrael. I was told that Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef paskin, you have to carry firearms even on Shabbos. But that presupposes you're carrying firearms 6 days a week. Now, in America, I still believe, and of course, the facts have to be ascertained, it's more dangerous to carry a firearm than not to carry one. A combination of accidents with guns, or chalila, the gun be turned on you. I believe still that it's safer to walk around without a gun than with a gun 7 days a week. Nothing to do with Hilchos Shabbos. If someone disagrees and is carrying a gun, and that's the second part of the question, in light of what's going on in Eretz Yisrael and in Europe, if a Jew felt threatened in the U.S., can he carry a weapon on Shabbos and Yontif? I'm not happy with a weapon, as I said to you, even 7 days a week. I think it's more dangerous to have one than not to have one, as a rule. If there is a specific danger in a particular place, maybe the person should stay home and not chance walking outside. We've already spoken in the past about some of the security teams in the shuls that I think are overdone, as a general rule. This is not to be somehow not concerned with pikuach nefesh. Chas v'shalom. I have a Kabbalah from my Rebbe, from Reb Chaim. We have to be machmir pikuach nefesh, even at the expense of Vilchus Shabbos. And I believe that's correct psak v'halacha. But here, we're discussing a totally different kind of an idea. People are going to go with firearms, which they endanger others who are near them, and you never know what's going to happen. And I'm hesitant. People should carry guns even during the week, as I said, and therefore to be matzah on Shabbos to me is even a bigger stretch, and I would not normally allow it. If you, as I said last time, if you want the shul to be protected, do what Rabbi Avadya Yosef's son, Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef Paskind, have an armed guard in the front. Ideally, the armed guard should be at least here at Nachri. So this way, at least when you're in the shul, you're protected, and hopefully you'll get the shul safe. If you're really, really fearful, I think you should stay home. That's my approach. The same thing applies to cell phones. This last question. A cell phone, to me, is very inappropriate on Shabbos. People, cell phones are not just phones. They are a person's life, his business life. Everything is in it. All his contacts. People just live with their cell phone. It would be, to my mind, not only what I call a Shabbos Chilul Shabbos, which perhaps we can be matir for Pikuach Nefesh, it's what I call Bittul Shabbos. You have your cell phone, you have your whole office in your pocket. That's why I told Hatzalah, if they need to carry something, they should carry an old-fashioned two-way radio that they used for all the years. This is much better, because on that two-way radio, you don't have any stock tips, you don't have any appointments. Nothing. It's just for communication purposes. So that's why I'm very much not a fan of a cell phone. And once again, if it's too threatening to go out, so don't stay home. I'm not rushing to be mad to people to carry cell phones on Shabbos. It could be, again, a very rare exception, which warrants carrying some kind of a device. And I'm not here to rule it out completely. But as a general rule, I believe that cell phones should be turned off, left off on Shabbos. Frankly, I don't see the connection between the terrible tragedy in Eretz Yisrael, which is a terrible, terrible tragedy. Our hearts bleed. We're still crying. But what does that have to do with the United States? Hod l'Hashem ki tov, b'li ayin hara, the United States has so far been much more safe than the Holy Land. Yes, we should daven for our brothers and sisters in Eretz Yisrael. We should certainly do it, including on Shabbos. But to carry around a gun or a cell phone because of a terrible event in the Holy Land, I think, is not appropriate. Rabbos, I thank you very much for listening.
Rebbe, I want to thank you very much, and we hope we can call upon you again.
B'siyata d'shmaya.
Okay, thank you, everyone. Have a good day.
Call to. Bye-bye.